Hello, this is Robert Kiyosaki, and I'm doing an audio version for Rich Kid, Smart Kid, and I'm very happy to be doing this because education is a subject that's near and dear to my heart. For those who may not know my background, my real dad was the head of education for the state of Hawaii. He's a very, very smart man. I'd probably say he was an academic genius. And then my rich dad, from the book Rich Dad, Poor Dad, my rich dad was my best friend's father. And he was a man who started with nothing, but ultimately became one of the wealthiest men in the state of Hawaii. So my background, well, I was influenced by having two very smart dads, but one was, I would say, an academic genius, and the other was a financial genius. And as we know, we teach very little about the subject of money at school. So it was kind of an interesting dichotomy to have an educator as a dad, but having my best friend's father be a financial guy who taught me things completely different. So Rich Kid, Smart Kid is really about what you can do to give your child a financial head start in life through education. As we all know, the idea of job security is an obsolete idea. The idea of working all your life and then expecting the company or the government to take care of you once your retirement days are over are kind of an industrial age idea, and we're now in the information age. So one of the big differences or the reasons I do this tape is simply because, or write this book, is because there is the world of academia, and then there's a real world outside of it. And my question has always been, does the world of academia prepare your child for the real world? In my experience, they're almost completely opposite. I mean, what is valuable in school is not valuable in the real world many times. For example, I've had a lot of trouble in school. I love learning, I love studying, but I hated school. And when I was in school, by the time I was age 15, I flunked out for the first time, and if not for my smart dad, I might have stayed flunked out, and they held me in. But my mother hit a panic. You know, she says, son, you have an F, you're a failure for life, you'll never be successful now, and you're, you know, for her, it was more traumatic for her than for me. And my smart dad, my academic father, sat me down. He says, look, son, you know, sometimes you have to study things you don't like to study. That's part of life. Or sometimes you must do things you don't want to do. If not for his counseling, I might have dropped out of school at that point because it was such a traumatic experience to be labeled stupid or learning disabled and an idiot on top of all that and disliked by the teacher. My rich dad, on the other hand, I went to see him and I was really despondent. And I was 15 years old, called a failure in school. And he sat me down also and counseled me. And he said, son, grades are important while you're in school and you must do your best to study and learn. And he had the same advice. Sometimes in life we study things or we do things we don't really want to do, but we have to do them. So I said, okay. Then he said, gave me one of the biggest tips of all. He said, son, always remember that my banker has never asked me for my report card yet. And that was when I started to realize there was a difference between the school world, academic world, and the real world. So the point of my book and this tape is to prepare your child not only for school, but for the real world. In the academic world, grades are everything. In the financial world, or the world the bankers operate, financial intelligence is everything. And in reality, to be successful today in the information age, you need both worlds. Unfortunately, our school system is still teaching us in one world only. And hopefully that'll change soon. As I always say, there's three different kinds of teachers. There's teachers who want change, the other type of teachers that fight change, and the third type of teacher doesn't care as long as they get their paycheck. So the world will change eventually as we come to the next millennium and things like this. Doing this tape with me right now is a very dear friend of mine, Kathy Colby, and the reason I'm very happy to have her as part of this tape because it's not about academics and it's not about finance, it's about how we learn. And as I said earlier, is that one of the frustrations I had in school is I love learning. I study voraciously. Today I read constantly. And the problem is I had trouble in school is because I was forced to study things I had no interest in, absolutely. Plus, on top of that, they made me sit down, sit still, listen, do as I was told, don't make mistakes, don't talk, which absolutely drives me berserker. And it's not my learning style. So what I'm going to be talking to Kathy about today is four different learning styles. She has a brilliant program called the Colby. You can find her work on colby.com. Our company uses it for adults, but she also has products for young people 5 and above. So Kathy, would you mind giving us, you know, first of all, thanks for being here, but would you mind giving us a little introduction about yourself and how you came about to develop the Colby process?
Well, I also was very influenced by my dad. My dad was the creator of personnel tests in the workplace, instruments used in hiring, the Wunderlich personnel test. And the personality test that he created was very much geared to how smart you are and what kind of details and facts you can remember. And as a kid who's dyslexic and dysgraphic, and I had a few other disses, I kept saying, "Dad, this isn't fair." He'd say, "Well, life isn't fair, Kathy. You will have to learn how to take these kinds of tests." And I did, and I figured out how to get through school, but it never was fair because I had a different way of learning. So I kept analyzing the learning process. And as I became a parent, seeing what was happening with my own kids in the school system, I said, you know, they're not being valued for who they are and for doing things in a way that works best for them any more than I was. And yes, I could tell them life wasn't fair, as I certainly have, and I could tell them they had to learn how to learn the way that schools taught. But I started to dissect the pattern for how people not only learn but make decisions of all types. And I found there are 12 basic methods of solving problems, 12 talents or geniuses. These 12 are universal in every population everywhere on the globe. I find that these are the 12 methods we use. But four of them are natural for each person. Four of them are the way that you get things done when you're doing your best work.
Because we use Kathy's work in our company. And what she's saying, there's 12 different geniuses, and each of us has four which we're the best at. So we have four different types of geniuses. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. And that means that each of us have four ways that we can succeed.
Does it also mean, though, if a child's genius is not in compliance or in alignment with the school's idea of genius, a child can get in trouble?
Absolutely, and that's what happened to you. May I share your result with the audience?
Sure.
Okay. Robert's main way of solving a problem or learning anything is to take it on as a risk, as a challenge. He's what I call a quick start initiator. He begins the problem solving process by trying to do it fast, cut to the bottom line. He's very visionary. This quick start mode that he operates in is one where he is insistent upon doing it his own unique way, not the way that it's already been done before. He's always trying to create a new process for getting to this bottom line faster.
So when we first met, you said that if I was in school today, I'd be drugged, wouldn't I?
Well, I'm afraid you would be called ADD, attention deficit disorder, and they've added other negatives into it because
right.
The double negative of attention deficit disorder wasn't enough for them. Well, the ADD child, we find, is often the quick start that you have. And then you have a second method of problem solving, which is your very strong ability to see things in tangible form, in three dimension.
What you call the implementer.
That's the implementer instinct. And you're highly accommodating, and you have a need to get up and move around, which is why the classroom that makes you sit little ducks in a row was so confining to you.
Right. And when I met Kathy, she says, life was hard after kindergarten. I said, how did you know? And the reason life was hard after kindergarten was it took the blocks away. They didn't let me mess them around. Then in the first grade, they made me stack them neatly, which doesn't fit my style anyway.
Right. And by third grade, they've taken the clay and everything else tangible out of the classroom.
So an implementer like me now has no, I don't learn that way.
There's no outlet for an implementer in our grade schools. None. The next time you would get an outlet is when you would be in a voc ed class or a trade school program
right.
where you could build and construct things mechanically or some science labs. But for you, it became a nightmare early. First grade, it started to get bad. By third grade, it was an absolute awful situation.
Absolutely horrible.
Yeah.
I couldn't stand it by then.
What the schools do is focus on, in the primary grades, what I call the follow-through, which is being sure that you write neatly, that you do everything in a routine.
Dress
You're smiling.
Neatly.
Dress neatly. I call it the starch-dress syndrome, where the kid that comes to school looking neat is immediately favored by the classroom teacher.
Right, and what you said, they want you to start writing between the lines. They don't like you coloring outside the lines.
Which is
point.
What you did.
Yeah, I can't stand following those lines.
Quick starts are drawn to a lot of color and to talking, so that's why you interrupted all the time and you wanted to get up and talk. And then you combine that with the implementer need to move around. You got up out of your seat and started talking.
Jumped out the window.
Did you literally?
Yes. I couldn't stand it. I can't stand being confined.
And that's your MO. That's your instinct. What we're talking about with the Kolbe, and by the way, Kolbe is spelled with a K, K-O-L-B-E. There are people who told me I didn't know how to spell my name because I was so often wrong.
So what Kathy was saying right now is that there's four different major learning styles. One is the fact finder. One is the follow-through, and that's the person who follows between the lines. There's a quick start, which is my dominant trait. And then the implementer, which is the person who likes to work with their hands or work outdoors.
And that's your subdominant. And we haven't defined fact finder because you and I have in common a resistance to it. So it's the last one we're going to get to.
That's the details, right?
Details, specificity, historical evidence, the way things have been done in the past. And for two people like us, it's a matter of, yeah, we know how bad it was. Let's get on to the reform.
Right. So in school, what they like is the historical or the fact finding, because something can only be a fact if it's historical.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It's
you know, something
study.
In the future is not yet a fact.
So when someone says to you, but Robert, where's your proof? Well, your proof is literally in the pudding, in the things you make, and in the response you get from people and the success they have. And they're saying, no, I mean statistically, how did you know this would work before you advised it? And that's because fact finders have a scientific approach where they do that.
Right, a fact finder will do their research. They'll read the papers on it. They'll make sure everything is accurate, neat, ready to go before they take action.
Right.
Whereas I don't want that. I don't need that.
They make wonderful strategists. My son is an attorney and is a fact finder and is the general counsel for our company. And while he and I have conflict because I don't give him all the specificity and I don't want to hear all his details back, thank goodness he's there because he catches those nuances and the specifics that need to be dealt with and weighs the pros and cons. So it's important to have all 12 of these talents.
I think that's probably the most brilliant thing I came when I met Kathy was that she gives dignity and respect to the different learning styles, the 12 different geniuses. For instance, in a company, you need 12 geniuses and 4 different learning styles. Whereas in school, the person that's rewarded is generally the fact finder or follow-through person who sits there and takes a test on their own. And for those who read my other books, I say that business and investing are team sports. You know, I do it with a group of people because, you know, and we all know two minds are better than one, except in school. And in school, you have two minds, you know, at test time, that's called cheating.
Well, that's right. The reality of life is that two minds are always better than one as long as we're not cloned on these four instincts. So we need to have people who have differences.
And this is the part that I love about Kathy's work, especially in the corporate world or in the business world. She gives dignity to people who come with different skills, different MOs, different instincts, because to survive in the business world, we need all 12 to make it. And that's why oftentimes somebody who's self-employed or an individual struggles because they're actually working handicapped. I mean, they don't have all 12 geniuses.
For the sake of those fact finder follow-throughs, Robert, you're trying to figure out how we go from 4 learning styles to 12 talents or geniuses. It's because in each one of those 4 learning styles, fact finder follow-through, quick start, implementer, there are 3 zones. There's the initiating zone. So when we say someone's a fact finder, we mean they initiate problem solving that way.
They like it. They love finding facts.
And they need it.
Yes.
It's a drive. It's an internal energy. And then there is an accommodation in the middle zone, and that's where you're willing to do it if you have to. You'll accommodate, you'll facilitate that. And the third zone is the preventative zone. And I happen to believe that preventing a problem by not getting too immersed in a particular method is
analysis,
important.
Paralysis, which a lot of the
fact finders, yeah.
Fact finders.
If you get a room full of fact finders, you will have analysis paralysis. They'll sit around and argue the details and they don't have enough data. You get a room full of insistent quick starts and you're going to have the paralysis of too many ideas, people talking over each other, all kinds of brainstorming going on, but who's going to make it happen? The preventative fact finder is your generalist. That's the person who cuts right through it.
And that's what
that's
I am,
you.
Right?
That's you.
You give me the data and I'll simplify it as quickly as I possible. I'll get to the bottom line, okay. As simple, as quick, headline it, don't give me the details.
That's right. Your book is full of bullet points.
That's right.
And so it's an easy read. I love reading your book because I don't get bogged down in long paragraphs.
All the detail.
Yeah. You give me the overview. You give me the bullet points. That's a talent just as much as your quick start is. But when you were in school, when the teacher asked you on a test question, the answer, if you just simplified it and gave her the two
big
things
picture
that were most important, she'd call you smart aleck.
Right, or that I don't have enough detail.
Right, you had to know the date and the names, etc. Well, it's not to say that being a fact finder is bad, as you point out. It's to say that why should someone be graded down because they got the key points as opposed to getting every single
detail.
Yeah. So when you look at the resistance to follow through, we are seeing a pattern that is somewhat chaotic, but I would use a positive phrase and say that the person who's preventative and follow through is highly adaptive. These are the people who can juggle. So if you have a kid who is preventative and follow through, probably a messy room, you keep saying, clean up your room. Well, their idea of cleaning up, if they're a quick start preventative follow through, is to wait until the last minute. Does that ring a bell with you?
Right. And sure. It's always messy. You hide it anyway.
Right under the bed. And then what becomes important is to recognize, yes, but at the last minute they pull it off. When your mother-in-law is coming to visit and they know how important that is, okay, all of a sudden everything gets cleaned up. It's also important.
It's done quickly, too.
if they have the quick start to go with right. the preventative follow-through, yes. And so we look at these combinations and we begin to see patterns of behavior. I now have 4 9/10 grandchildren. Went on the way. I guess I'd be 8
Congratulations,
nine.
Yeah.
See my math. Thanks. I look at these little guys and I see these patterns from infancy. That little fact finder baby who's got the little finger out there touching and poking carefully, not taking risks, not seeming to have much quick start, but needs to have everything done in a pattern. In fact, as he got to be 2.5 and 3 and we're saying, hands and face, going to wash your hands and face. If you start with the face instead of hands, he gets all upset. There's a pattern we're supposed to follow. Then you look at the little 5-month-old grandchild I've got who has to touch and feel everything.
What would that person be?
Implementer.
Implementer.
It's clear she's an implementer. Everything is texture. She either likes it or dislikes it based on touch.
They touch, right?
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things you would have had. Well, we see these patterns come in from infancy because this is innate. This is instinct.
What would a follow-through baby be? That's the person who likes to write between the lines and be neat.
The follow-through kid is the one who hates to be messy. Actually, they get dirt on them and they come and tell you, dirty, dirty. They want to have it cleaned up, washed off. You don't have to tell them to stay out of puddles. If they do, they just put their toe in it. And they need structure. If you move the things in their bedroom, it's very unsettling for them if you change the routine. So if you go to a pediatrician and he says, now you must keep a schedule, you must keep a routine, that's in all probability a follow-through doctor doing the same thing teachers do, telling you as a parent to do what would work for them and therefore they think it's the right way. What we have to do is get past that. The right way is the way that works
for the child
and the family. And we have to get the child to learn to operate within a system. Robert, there's something really interesting about this, which your case points out. We don't find instincts are genetic. So on the Kolbe system, what we've done after now lots of research is identified parents aren't necessarily going to have kids in their own image in terms of this instinctive nature. So imagine your father, your real father, who was probably, from what you tell me, a fact finder follow through, raising a kid who is his instinctive opposite, a quick start implementer. You must have driven him nuts.
Oh, we did not get along. It was really, I mean, I had to pretend to be like him to survive inside the household. You know, I had to kowtow or be a good boy. And good boy was by his definition of a good boy. To throw a football through the window was not his idea of a good boy.
No. A fact finder tends to set up a lot of rules.
He had a lot. There's a right way and a wrong way.
Mm-hmm. That is a more of a fact finder method of parenting. And if he was a follow-through, there was also a rigidity of time and system. You do this now, you study before you play.
Right.
You know, there's no sense to that for a quick start implementer. Go out and play and have fun and work all that energy off. Then it's going to be easier to study. So if we know a child's MO, if folks will have their kids take the youth index, the Kolbe index for kids tells us what are their strengths and how do they need to study. Now, the fact finder needs to read a book and needs to be sure they're getting the information. The follow-through needs that information in context. Why am I learning this? How does it work? So when a follow-through kid starts a puzzle, they do the outside, you know,
they want the framework first. Huh?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. You don't do the framework. You match colors. You find the pieces of the puzzle that fit because they're all red or all green or whatever.
And then I'll get a couple fitting, then I'll skip to do something else. I mean, I have the attention span of a cockroach sometimes. You know, I can't stay with one thing for too long.
You know, you say that, but actually that sounds as if cognitively you can't keep a thought going. And I've seen that you can, but you get up and move around and talk about
right.
it while you're doing it.
Right.
So you're skipping from one to another, but you're working on that puzzle the whole time.
Right.
So when people say this kid is distractible, Well, not necessarily in terms of getting the puzzle done. You might get it done as faster than others, but you don't do it the way it's taught in school.
Okay.
The quick start talks it through. The quick start brainstorms. The quick start uses color. And the implementer is going to use the tangible, the texture. So you're fitting
The
together the
shapes,
puzzle.
yeah.
You would use the shapes and not the way the follow through would in terms of geometry, but you use them by actually trying to, you tried to fit them together. You tried to force them. And if it didn't go easily, you knew it was wrong.
Right.
But it was trial and error pushing it together. That's your quick start implementer. So what we begin to see is that a parent may be in natural conflict as you were with your dad. That doesn't make him or you less
Wrong.
intelligent or
That's
wrong.
right.
That's right. But it sure makes it tough.
Well, that's the good thing about my dad was he always realized that he used to say to me, "You don't belong in school." And he didn't mean that derogatorily. He says, "You're not the kind of child that does well in school. You'll never learn. You won't sit there for very long." And at least he had a way of realizing that. So one of the things I wanted you to talk about in this tape is, first of all, Kathy has her Kolbe-Childs index. But very importantly is what happens if you have a child who is having a difficult time. Let's say the child is a quick start and the teacher is one of these fact finder follow-throughs, which a lot of them are, like which you said a lot of bureaucrats are follow-through because you give them, they do as they're told, they don't disturb them, they won't shake the apple cart up and all this. But you have this hyper kid inside the classroom, and let's say it's your child, and the child's having a hard time. What would you say to a parent who's having a child who they claim is ADD, is disruptive, and is having conflicts with the teacher? How would you address that problem?
The first thing I would do is respect the teacher's need if the teacher is an insistent follow-through to have an orderly classroom. And I would empathize with that teacher and find out if that's one of the things that's causing this. And I find in the elementary primary grades that's often true. Then talk with the teacher about how can you as the parent help manage the situation for this child so the child is not disruptive. And ask questions such as, if I were your dad or mom, I would say, now, if Robert stands up and walks around the room, how can he do it in a way that isn't disruptive? And how can you make that okay so you don't have to stop and reprimand him? Or what can he do that isn't noisy, that isn't going to make it hard for the other kids? And then why does Robert need to do every single one of the problems in the book on the certain page? If he proves that he knows maybe by doing every other one, could he then skip on and do something else or do extra credit projects, maybe put on a puppet show or something? So I would start to work with the teacher to be part of the team. I definitely do not recommend that you go in and say, "Hey, lady, what are you doing to my kid?" and be negative. This is a human being who, for the most part, chose education because they want to make a difference. You have to
Correct.
go in with a positive, helping that person meet his or her needs too. I think it's important that when we look at helping the child work in the classroom, that we teach the child negotiating skills. And boy, does that help, as you well know, in business
That's
once you've
right.
learned it. You probably learned just by being a quick start how to negotiate with teachers.
I had to.
What's an example?
Well, I remember when I didn't do my homework one day, and it was a speech class. I said, well, she wanted me to turn in the page. I said, well, if I get the best grade for my speech above everybody else's, is it okay I don't have to hand in a written piece of paper? And basically, I challenged her. I said, if I can deliver a better speech without having a written speech, and at that moment, she says, yeah, go for it.
There you go.
And what I did was I talked about surfing, and I took a table. And I just did this whole talk using, the table like an implementer would, having this a prop or a, thing, something I could move around. I could actually demonstrate what surfing was like, and I got the highest grade for my peers.
And you use the quick start gift of gab, the talking, and you use the implementer hands-on
Showing, yeah,
demonstration.
show and tell.
So you literally, yeah, show and tell by the terms are quick start implementer.
Right.
Now, I'm a quick start follow-through dyslexic. So I would.
Excuse me for laughing, but I think it's kind of interesting to be proud of
Well, I
it
am
too.
because it was
Gives
such
you
a.
character.
And the joy of problem solving. I
Right.
learned very, very young that the probability that I was going to say it backwards or write it backwards or draw it in an odd shape was going to bring laughter. So I started using that humor as a positive. And I would get up and I would do things on purpose the wrong way Sometimes then it was hard to remember which was the right way. But I would play to that. And in the process, I would be figuring out what did it take? How did I have to change the pattern? Because I had a pattern with my follow through, it was just the wrong pattern. And I had to make that work. I had to make it okay. So I created a new set of vowels, and I did it with color, and I started spelling with color, and it taught me how to spell. I won't say I became great until I became an editor, but the whole point is, if you teach kids how to build on their strengths, there are no such things as weaknesses.
Thank you. The reason I wanted Kathy on this tape, that was the most important thing. You don't believe in learning handicaps or learning difficulties. Mm-hmm. They can be turned into strengths if you work with the child. And I think that's probably the reason I tell the story about my dad, even though I had an F, he taught me at that moment that sometimes you study things because you don't know why you're studying them at that moment. But sometimes you study them because you're going to be using it in the future. You may not know now. And instead of punishing me, he took me to what I call a higher plane of thought or a higher level of intelligence. So as a young boy, I understood that maybe being intelligent was studying things I didn't want to study and trusting somebody older than me to guide me at this time. So rather than rebelling or arguing with me, he guided me to what I call a higher level of thought. And that's what I've noticed that you have done with Colby, is you have taken everybody's strengths, regardless if the school system likes it or not, and turned them, or weaknesses, and turned them into strengths. And I think that is really humane. It is a very gentle and kind way of treating every individual as unique and as of contribution.
Some people would say it's not gentle at all. What it is forcing people to build on who they are, and that's confronting them with the fact that you don't have any excuses. Being a dyslexic or being ADD or whatever label someone wants to put on you, it is not a cop-out.
Good. Thank you.
Who you are is who you were meant to be.
Right.
And if we know that about every child who comes into the world, and we say, okay, you've got to take this MO you've got, this toolbox, this set of talents, and you've got to put them to good use. So now our role as a parent is to validate the child's talent, reinforce it, and challenge it. Don't let kids off the hook. And I think that's one of the things we do with drugs and we do with a lot of our programs for so-called handicapped kids. I mean, there are very, very few kids who are in themselves handicapped. The system handicaps them, because it doesn't deal with them often enough.
Often it just labels them.
Yeah, and negative labels.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not going to say that there aren't kids who don't present huge challenges to an educator. There are, and many, many, most educators try very hard to meet the needs of the child. It's that they haven't recognized that there's a part of the mind beyond intelligence measured on IQ tests. It's this instinctive strength.
Please, everybody say that. What Kathy taught me was instinct, you call what?
The conative.
Conative. And academic learning is what?
Cognitive.
And this personality is?
Affective.
Affective. And so a lot of times in our school system, especially in the, you know, Miss Congeniality and Mr. Popularity, is a personality contest. And people who are popular in school do very well. And cognitive is the academic learning. And what Kathy Colby focuses on is conative, is your instinctive, it's who you are. It doesn't mean you can't do things differently, but there are certain things you do very well, very naturally, very instinctively. And I think that what she has brought, a lot of humanity, a finer distinction, and a more gentler way of accepting people who are different rather than saying that you're smart and you're stupid. And I think that is the cruelest system I have ever seen. That's why I fought, that's why I hated school. Is, you know, I remember in school, they wiped out the Hawaiian kids first because they were good at music and they're generally good athletes, but they weren't good at math and science. Thank God I was good at math and science, because I would have been wiped out probably by high school. You know, I mean, because math and science, I liked, I enjoyed that. But kids who didn't, if you could sing or you could play football, you were a dummy and you were gone. And what Kathy has done is bring respectability, and she's respected them for who they are. And I think that is absolutely brilliant. One last thing before we end. Let's say you have a child who is a quick start, rambunctious, ricochet rabbit, all over the place, Spider-Man, what they call him, and all this. As a parent, what would you say to a child like that? How would you counsel them?
I would laugh a lot with them instead of at them. I would show them that I think that that's a wonderful, joyful approach to life, and I'd say, now, how are we going to make this work?
In school.
Yeah. What do you have to do to make this so it isn't something that's going to bug this kid sitting next to you or make your teacher distracted, because teachers are as distractible as kids sometimes. So I would teach them compassion, and I would teach them values for other people, that yes, their way is important, and we're going to do as much of that as at home as possible, and help them see that they can be a part of this classroom of people that's not unlike the family environment, where not every child in the family is alike, not unlike the work environment, and get them used to trying to figure out how to meet their needs without harming other people's needs. And I think that kind of a discourse can start very, very young.
Thank you. That's brilliant. So would you mind telling the listeners what the Colby Child Index can do to help support the parents bringing out the child's natural genius and doing better in school and getting along better with people and kids as well as parents?
We call it the Colby Youth Index, or the Colby Y, and it, again, it's K-O-L-B-E. And you can go to our website, www.colby.com, and have your child take the youth index, and there what you will find is that we will tell you what are the 4 natural talents for your child, and we'll give some coaching to you and your child and how to build on those strengths, and we'll also help by showing what the other strengths are, that so that your kids can become more aware of differences in a positive light and see diversity as strength.
That's great. So again, it's www.colby.com. It's the Y, or Youth Index. They also have the Adult Index for the A. And anybody in business, please, you should take it. And if you're married, you and your spouse should do it, so you can understand how to talk to each other. Because we're all unique at some level and different in other ways, and we respond differently.
Our relationship program is pretty interesting, because you can compare what you wish the other person to do with what they really do.
The way they should be?
Right.
Anyway, it's really a pleasure. If I could close right now on a little financial note, one of the biggest questions I'm asked about is, how do I handle allowance? And it's a very important question, simply because money, as we all know, is a very powerful teaching and training tool. You can bribe them. You can do a lot of things with money. And people say, well, how early should I start talking to my child about money? I said, well, I notice a 5-year-old knows the difference between a 1 and a 20 really early. So the earlier, the better. But when it comes to money, let me hit the backtrack. One of the definitions I heard of stupidity was, stupidity is doing something and not realizing the consequences of. For instance, if you smoke and you don't know it's bad for your health, that's pretty stupid. I mean, it's okay to smoke, I guess, if you know what you're doing and you know the consequences of it. At least you're aware of it. But just to do something and not look at the long-term consequences is it. So money as a training program has that same type of long-term consequences. In some of the families, I notice that the children have, they come up to them and say, well, give me my allowance because I'm entitled to it. And what you're doing, if you give a child, just give them the allowance because they're entitled to it, in my opinion, you're teaching them the entitlement mentality. Now, in other families, they give kids allowance for doing chores. So they come in, they say, well, I cleaned up my room. Well, I did the dishes, how much are you going to pay me? I took out the garbage, how much are you going to pay me? Well, my rich dad often said, he says, son, in real life, you don't get paid to clean up your room. In real life, you don't get paid to wash the dishes. In real life, you don't get paid to take out the garbage. That's part of life. So the thing I say to people, if you pay a child to do chores, you train them to be employee mentality. I'll do something if you pay me. So there's now entitlement and employee. The third type, and was the way that my rich dad and my poor dad raised me, was that I had to do my dishes, I had to clean the house, I had to do the lawn, I didn't get paid. If I wanted to earn money, I had to create opportunities. I had to see what was needed to be done. And my rich dad said, if you're a type of person who sees opportunities and negotiates the deal, as you say, is that you're training your child to be an entrepreneur. It's a person who creates businesses, who's more independent and all this. So as I said again, stupidity is, you know, doing something and not realizing the long-term consequences. So with every dollar you give your child, or you reward your child, or you offer your child the opportunity, you're training them in some way. And so that's what I have to say about allowance. And money is a very powerful training tool. So thank you all for, first of all, taking the time to be interested in your child's education. After all, a parent is a child's most powerful and influential teacher. And many people pay lip service to education. They say, I want my child to go to school and study, but they themselves don't go to school and don't study. And as both my dads said, actions speak louder than words. Both my dads studied, both my dads worked hard, and that's I learned from what they did, not what they said to me. So thank you for taking the time and being interested in your child's education. And thank you, Kathy, for really supporting, clarifying the four different learning types. And it's been really a joy working with you.
Thanks.